content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today from the fiction section of the February 27, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Last Grown-Up, by Allegra Goodman. The stairs. Water running in their bathroom. She sent her daughters everywhere, but it was just her imagination. They were gone. Of course they would come back. They were safe, and it was just till Sunday. It wasn't death. It only felt like that. Her friend said, "Now you can rest. You can think. You can work out." Theoretically, she could have done these things. She could have been thinking and going to the gym and resting. But when the girls left with their father, Deborah sat on the couch and cried. Which was fine. Crying was good. Divorce was hard. All she had to do was call, and her sister Becca would come right over, but Deborah didn't want sympathy. So no one saw her tears, except the dog. Max was a Samoyed and pure of heart. If anyone was injured, he came running, first from her bike. Max had rushed to lick her better. But where was Deborah hurt? She couldn't explain, so she buried her face in his white fur. Eventually, Deborah got up and preheated the oven to 425. She poured a bag of frozen shoestring fries into a cookie sheet, a sprinkle of salt, a dollop of ketchup, and that was dinner, which she ate right on the couch. It wasn't good for her, but she was listening to her body, and her body said, "Who cares?" She called her parents down in Florida, and her mom said, "Hi, honey, how are you doing?" "I'm okay," Deborah said, balancing her plate on the arm of the couch. "Ed," her mom said, "Deborah's on the phone." Deborah's dad picked up and said, "What's new?" "Our paperwork is finished." "It's finalized?" Her mom was disbelieving. It had been so long. "Done." She could hear her parents mulling what to say. The paperwork was done, and it was weird and painful, like picking off a scab, because the marriage itself had ended 2 years before. "Well, that's a relief," her mom said. But Deborah's dad spoke in the voice he reserved for his deepest disappointments. "All right, that's that." "I'm wondering," Deborah's mom ventured, "should I take down your wedding picture?" "Cindy," her dad chided. "You've still got that picture up?" Deborah said. Her mom sounded embarrassed. I was just," Deborah said. "It's fine either way. You don't mind?" "Why should I mind a picture?" Deborah asked, though in retrospect she thought her beaded gown unfortunate. "I have the whole album." "You look at your album?" her mother said, gasping. "No, but I'm not going to get rid of it. The girls might want it. I'm not erasing history." Silence. And she knew that her mom was gazing at the photo in its gilt frame. "You look so happy." "I was happy," Deborah said. "And Richard was so young." "Yes, Mom, he was young." Deborah almost laughed, and then she felt guilty for mocking, even inwardly, because how could her parents know what to say? How could anybody? What clueless things would Deborah tell her own daughters? They were in 10th and 7th grade and obviously a million years from marrying, let alone divorcing, but if they did. "Would you admit the truth?" Deborah asked herself. "Would you say this was not what I imagined?" Deborah took out the trash and picked up a package by the door. New earbuds for Sophie, who had lost hers. Then she took Max out to romp and sniff and chase his rubber ball in the backyard. The girls never set foot here anymore. At 16 and 13, their days of racing and foraging were done. But Max never outgrew anything. "You need a yard, Maxie. Yes, you do." She threw the ball, and he streaked off, untiring. Did he wonder where the girls had gone? Deborah was sure he missed them, and she was glad he didn't know it would get worse. In just 2.5 years, Sophie would leave for college. Lily would follow, and then what? Deborah didn't want to sell the house, but could she and Max afford to stay? Would he even live that long? Oh, no. Admittedly, Deborah tended toward the worst-case scenario. It made Richard crazy because she was always, as he said, fast-forwarding. But she had foresight. She prepared. She planned meals and vacations, scheduled lessons, pre-registered for summer camp. Slow down, Richard would beg her. Cut back. Get help. Of course, he never considered helping. When they fought, he said, "But you insist on doing everything." This was true. No one had ever told up free time and exercise. When they were older, she gave up her job, because two people could not work the kind of hours they did and see their children while they were awake. And because she wanted to eat real food, and because she did not want to outsource every single aspect of her life, and because those were the years you could not get back, and because she hoped someday to return, if not to law, something new, education, social justice, counseling. Together, Deborah and Max examined icy puddles under the girl's old climbing structure and green slide. It was exhilarating to think of all the possibilities, how she might teach for or advocate for immigrants. But when she thought of Richard, she saw his future as domestic. He would remarry. It was obvious to her, to everyone. He was already living with his girlfriend, Heather, who was smart and beautiful and sane. The girls adored her. Deborah approved. As for Richard, he was better than he had ever been, eating healthy, losing weight. The girl said he'd stopped sneaking cigarettes. "Good for you," Deborah had told him a few days earlier. "Yeah, I'm doing it," Richard said. She looked at him with sudden insight. He was taking the plunge. The paperwork was done. "You're going to propose." He looked startled. "I meant quitting."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"I wouldn't propose without talking to the girls." He was reddening around the ears. She nodded. "That's smart. We want them to be..." "Yeah," she said. "Comfortable. We want it to be natural." "They'll be ecstatic," she encouraged him. "Thanks," he said. A sweet moment, a really good exchange. "I was proud of us," Deborah told her therapist, Suzanne, the next day. Truly, she was happy for Richard and relieved that he was done dating women half his age. Heather was someone Deborah could work with, someone she could respect. It was a good thing. It was the right thing. And at the same time, she knew that Richard's remarriage would sting. The greater good would be another loss. "Yes, Suzanne?"
"Totally.
But what can I do about it?"
"Do you always have to do something?" Suzanne answered.
And Deborah sighed because she knew that sometimes there was nothing to be done with feelings but to feel them. There was nothing to be done about her ex-husband and his new relationship except to watch events unfold. Deborah understood all that. She was good at therapy. If only Richard and Heather would hurry up and get it over with. That evening, Lily called from Richard's place.
"Guess what?" she said, and Deborah's heart leaped. This was it.
"What?" Deborah said. "We're making pizza from scratch."
"Oh,
we should do this sometime," Lily told her.
"Okay, sure," Deborah heard laughter in the background.
"Mom, we have to get a pizza stone."
"We have one."
"But it broke," Lily reminded her. "We should get another one."
"Okay."
"Then after dinner, we're getting gelato."
That was when Richard and Heather would tell the girls. Except they wouldn't tell them. They would ask. They would sit together, the four of them, and Richard would say, "Girls, we have a question for you." Or Heather would speak humbly,
"I will never replace your mom."
but I want to ask you if I can be on your team and support you forever. Or they would say together, girls, we have a present for you. You don't have to wear them all the time or ever, but we want to give you these necklaces. Deborah could imagine it every which way, the squeals of delight, the delicate gold chains, everything sensitive and meaningful. Richard would be kneeling, or Heather, or both of them, and there would be hugs and happy tears. Have a wonderful time, Deborah told Lily now. Let me know how it goes. Bye, Mom. Love you. Lily always said goodbye like that, and Sophie too. Love you, they chirped on every occasion. Carpool was late. Love you, until the words meant nothing. They might as well have said, talk soon. Where did that come from? Summer camp? It irked her, although it didn't bother anybody else. Plenty of parents spoke to their kids that way as well. Becca declared, I always say love you to my kids because who knows what could happen? What if you were hit by a bus? Wouldn't you want your last words to be love you? Deborah said, none of it's just habit. Love you, killed by a bus. The whole thing made her sad. She walked through the empty house. Then she vacuumed to the first floor and cleaned the girls' rooms. The kids won't learn to clean up after themselves if you do it for them, Richard used to remind her. He had been scrupulous about telling the girls to do whatever task Deborah required. Do as I say, not as I do. She shook her head and picked up laundry from the floor. School clothes, leotards, balled-up tights. Lily's rug was sea green, Sophie's fluffy white. She'd said she wanted white like Maxie's fur, and that was what she got. Her rug was furry, and it shed. Legos used to disappear in it. What was that caught in the white shag? An earbud right at the foot of Sophie's bed. And there was the other one. Right after the new ones were delivered. But she resisted. They'd be at the gelato place by now, finishing up, driving back to Richard's condo. Deborah expected the news any second, but nobody called. How was the gelato? She texted at last. Good, Lily texted back. When the girls returned, nothing had changed. Richard and Heather were not engaged. Deborah had been fast-forwarding again. Sophie asked, is that what you got? We tried Heather's. Deborah tried to picture Heather with a fruit flavor. Heather seemed more cookies and cream. It was weird, Lily said. But nothing else seemed strange to them. In fact, they were lighter, happier than when they had left. Trust Heather, a trail runner and a hiker, to leave kids better than she'd found them. The girls hugged Max, went up to their rooms, and did their homework. Did not seem sad at all, and curled up in bed with her book about girls learning to be witches or possibly princesses at boarding school. And life was good, and it was ordinary. It was school and ballet and groceries and dinner and pre-algebra and world history. And the next weekend, Deborah had the girls, and she made waffles. All was calm until the following Thursday. Then Richard came in and played with Max while the girls were dragging their bags downstairs. And he said in a low voice, Deborah, I have something to tell you. That was a bad sign. Go out to the car, Deborah called to the girls as Richard started pacing. He forgot Max completely. What is it? Deborah asked. Well, he began. Is it Heather? Yes. She froze. Were he and Heather breaking up now? Now that the girls were used to her? Had he really screwed up this relationship already? You didn't. Didn't what? He shot back, instantly defensive. Richard, what's going on? He hesitated for just a second, and then he said, we're expecting. Wait, what? We're expecting a baby in January. But I thought aren't you getting engaged? We're planning to. And when are you going to tell the girls? And when will you get married? I wanted to ask you about telling them. I mean, It's good news. And she took a breath. It's a lot of good news at once.
Exactly. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I was just surprised.
Well, we didn't want to wait too long.
Wait, she thought. You didn't wait at all.
Lissa, who? Heather's sister's having a terrible time getting pregnant.
Deborah stood there bewildered because they were talking about Heather's sister's infertility.
When are you getting married?
After the baby.
Okay, she said slowly. She had foreseen engagement and then marriage, not an instant family.
He said, are you worried it will be weird for the girls?
Well, yeah.
Because you think it's wrong to have a baby first?
No.
She wasn't going to be the bad guy, the moralistic one, the evil fairy at the christening. She realized something now. The king's first wife, that's who the evil fairy would have been. But that wasn't Deborah, not at all. She just needed a minute. She had never imagined Heather in a rush, or Richard so nervous and so glad, and she felt a pang hearing his good fortune. Once upon a time, Deborah had wanted a third child, but Richard had objected, and she had listened.
It's just too much at once.
That's why we want to talk to them.
The front door opened.
Dad?
Sophie said.
Lily called from the open car.
You're taking forever!
He called back. 1 second.
Let's figure out a plan, Deborah told Richard.
Great. He was speaking in that cheerful tone he adopted when the kids were near.
Deborah said, team meeting.
The three of them met at the abandoned luncheonette. Richard sipped kombucha and Deborah had black coffee and Heather had nothing.
Why don't you try the water? Deborah suggested.
He appreciated Deborah's sense of humor.
Of course she did, because she was perfect, even if she looked a little pale.
How are you feeling? Deborah asked.
Heather said, and Richard took her hand.
She's a trooper. Richard could have been talking about Lily, but Heather didn't seem offended.
Deborah asked, are you going to find out whether it's a boy or a girl?
They spoke at the same time.
I think so, Richard said.
I'm not so sure, Heather said.
Well, either way, Richard said.
Deborah interjected. But you're going to tell the girls that you're expecting.
Of course, Heather said.
Richard said, we have to.
Here's the thing, Deborah told them, and now she saw Richard getting tense.
He hated hearing a thing.
I think you should get engaged first, and then let a little time pass before telling them about the...
I think it's important for them to know
that we're all in this together, Heather said.
Exactly.
That this is forever, Heather said.
Deborah said, right.
As for Richard, he said nothing. He would do what Heather wanted. He, who had insisted he could not handle a third child.
This was different. Deborah understood that. This wasn't a third child born into their old family with their old wars. He and Heather were a new beginning.
This was the way of things, that women had their babies and they stopped while men lived like starfish, constantly regenerating.
I love the girls so much, Heather was saying. I want to include them when we get engaged.
Well, I got that part right, Deborah thought.
Heather said, I want to dedicate myself to them.
You're great, Deborah thought. You really are. And at the same idea, you have no idea. Parenting times three? The sleepless nights ahead, the tantrums and book reports and standardized tests and the million ways that kids in middle school are mean, Deborah said.
That's just a mini ritual. Anyone can practice that at whatever level. Just try it whenever you feel a need.
Thanks, Deborah said.
Will do.
She took Max home and let him run around while she sat on the girl's old swing. He was looking for his ball. Several times he ran up as if to ask, where did it go?
Max sniffed her knees. He wanted her to hunt, but she said, I can't, Max. Sometimes you have to rest, you know?
his ears pricked up. He could detect even a hint of sadness.
It's okay. It'll be okay, I promise. You keep looking, and if you still can't find your ball, I'll buy you a new one. And then as soon as I buy a new one, that old one will turn up.
Max buried his head in her lap as she said,
I don't know why it happens. It's funny, right? But that's just how it goes.
Proposal. Thank you, Deborah said and meant it. I think that will be wonderful, she told Heather, because why scare her? And the new baby would be beautiful. She envied Heather that, although she was grateful for the daughters that she had.
I'm glad we did this, Heather said when they were walking to the cars.
Richard hugged his future fiancé's shoulders. He kissed her ear.
And Deborah didn't feel alone at all. She didn't mind watching. She just felt like the last grown-up on Earth as she called after them, I'm glad we're all on the same page.
The next weekend, she was forewarned and forearmed. She had in her possession a folder with the proposal. Heather had sent it, so Deborah was like the press corps with the full text of the speech the president was about to give. And, better than the press, she had printed two copies on archival paper. To Richard and Heather pledged their troth, Deborah was sitting at the kitchen table framing the documents so that each girl would have a copy in her room. Family proposal. We propose to be there for each other every day, to respect differences and appreciate each person for who they are, to make sure everyone in our family is seen and heard, to honor each other's feelings, to be on one team. Deborah's phone was ringing. It was Lily, and she was on speaker, in the background talking as Lily shouted,
We're engaged!
Mazel tov!
And we're expecting, Sophie added.
Oh, wow, Deborah said automatically. So much for letting a little time pass.
That's so great.
Mom, Sophie said, you already knew, didn't you?
I can neither confirm nor deny, Deborah said, and she heard Heather saying, ha.
This is so great, Deborah repeated. This is really, really wonderful. She said it, but her body ached, her arms, her legs, her heart.
It's going to be a girl, Lily said.
Deborah said, they told you?
Lily just wants it to be a girl.
That was Sophie's older sister voice. The phone was ringing over at Richard's place. Deborah could hear it in the background.
Sorry, it's my parents, Heather said. Mom, hi.
We should talk to them, Richard said.
And we need to make dinner, Heather reminded him.
Crashing sounds and laughter. Heather's voice.
Yes, we're here with the girls. We all proposed to each other.
Okay, I have to go, Lily told Deborah after a minute.
Love you.
Everyone was happy. Everyone was young. As for Deborah, she was relieved. She was actually glad that Richard and Heather had shared all their news at once. She almost wished they'd revealed the gender, too, and named the baby, and that their perfect child was in school, and Richard was showing just how involved he could be the second time around. I have so much more patience now, he would say, as older parents always did. I'm so much calmer. Deborah wished it had all happened already, so she didn't have to watch. In the twilight, she got the leash and took Max for a walk. The earth was damp, the grass tender. The neighbor kids were biking up and down the street, looping in parabolas. She stood watching as she called her sister.
Hey, she said.
Immediately, Becca said,
The deed is done?
Yep.
And how was it?
It was great. It was beautiful.
Were you there?
You sound like you were there.
No, I wasn't there. I heard from the girls, and they also know about the baby.
I thought Richard was waiting to tell them. Well, apparently not. I thought you had that big meeting.
We did, and Richard sat there agreeing to everything.
There was a pause, and then Becca said,
He's just bad.
He isn't bad, Deborah said numbly.
Yes, he is.
He's inconsiderate, Deborah said. That doesn't make him bad. Whatever, Becca said. You can call it what you want. He blindsided you.
No, Max,
Deborah called. He was straining out the leash, barking at a beagle.
He's getting violent, Deborah told Becca. I have to go.
Max isn't violent. He has a thing about little dogs. Deborah was maligning her own sweet Max, just to get off the phone.
Hey, Deborah, it's okay to be angry, said Becca, who taught creative movement. You can scream. You can dance it out.
Deborah pulled Max across the street.
Yeah, I don't think I'm in that kind of shape right now.
No, anyone can do this. Listen, it takes 2 seconds. Plant your feet. Deborah planted her feet on the sidewalk as Max looked quizzically at her.
Breathe in and tighten your whole body. Make fists.
Uh-huh.
Then open your hands. Release your breath. Let go.
Deborah opened her left hand because she was still holding the leash in her right. She exhaled, and then she said,
let what go?
The whole thing. Oh!
And now, an article from the page-turner section of the February 21st, 2023 online edition of the New Yorker magazine. The Errant Mind of a Depressed Economist. Martin Riker's The Guest Lecture chronicles its narrator's wandering thoughts in the course of a single sleepless night. By Nathan Goldman. Early in Jordan Castro's recent book, The Novelist, the narrator, a frustrated fiction writer, unfavorably contrasts his own nascent project to Nicholson Baker's 1986 novel in monologue, The Mezzanine. Castro's would-be novelist is isolated, creatively paralyzed, and desperate to escape his own mind. He fears the book he is struggling to write, a fictionalized account of his own drug addiction, has, quote, no texture or insight at all, end quote. Baker's novel, which minutely tracks the thoughts of a young man named Howie over the time it takes him to approach and ascend an escalator, represents an ideal, an example of the kind of book he wants to write, but suspects he never will. Howie's mental meanderings are maniacally self-absorbed in a way Castro's narrator worries is true of his own roiling recursive thoughts. But Howie's solitary digressions, unlike those of Castro's protagonist, don't snare him in an agonizing spiral of self-consciousness. Though his body remains nearly still, his mind wanders exuberantly, touching on everything from the pleasure of rubbing a socked foot against office carpet to the fraught choreography of corporate restrooms. In the course of Baker's novel, these idle musings accrue into indulgent, lavishly layered perceptions of everyday objects and eventually become an ode to the infinite richness of even the most mundane phenomena. Howie may be isolated, but through his own scrupulous attention, he is returned to the world's wide openness. In Martin Riker's The Guest Lecture, the solitary self is neither as trapped as it is in Castro's novel, nor as transcendent as it is in The Mezzanine. The novel, a follow-up to Riker's surreal and decade-spanning Samuel Johnson's Eternal Return, published in 2018, chronicles the thoughts of a depressed economist named Abby over a single sleepless night as she lies in a hotel bed beside her husband Ed and daughter Ollie. Abby's anxious stream of consciousness is as neurotic and self-defeating as that of Castro's block novelist. But the novel Riker has constructed around her night-long monologue subtly puts her separation from the rest of existence into question. In its opening pages, the guest lecture situates the mind in relation to the world using a clever and surprisingly effective conceit. Abby, who is set to deliver a lecture to an unspecified audience the following day, commits her talk to memory using the loci method. The technique, a famous mnemonic device attributed to the ancient Greek poet Simonides, involves imagining a familiar space and mentally assigning a portion of the content that is to be memorized its own place. In the darkness of her hotel room,
Abby embarks on a recreation of every room in her house, imagining herself passing through each one in turn and retrieving the information she needs. Riker has provided a Virgil to her Dante in the form of the canonical 20th century economist John Maynard Keynes, the subject of the lecture for which she is preparing. This chimerical Keynes serves an ambiguous function, variously warm, needling, and obtuse. He explains his role in this way, quote, "Your lawyer, your confidant, your companion on this long night's journey through the house inside your head. But actually, as you know perfectly well, I am just your imagination. Anything I ask, you are asking yourself," end quote. Still, his presence in the solipsistic novel destabilizes the division of self and world, emphasizing the way an individual consciousness is always made up of the traces left by others. Throughout the guest lecture, Keynes endeavors to keep Abby on task. "My conscience, maybe," she calls him. "You need to stick to only the most relevant points," he advises her early in the novel, "or this talk will go on forever." The topic at hand is Keynes' 1930 essay, Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, in which he predicts that the incipient global depression will soon give way to economic growth so explosive that it will eradicate poverty within a century. Abby interprets this article not as a scientific document, but rather as a rhetorical and imaginative gesture that exhibits the economist's interest in, quote, "proposing a utopian space for thinking through how the world could be different," end quote. Keynes's optimism about the power of ideas to shape reality enchants Abby in part because of its dissonance with her own experience. Her own ideas don't seem to have the power to shape anything. Though Abby tries to stick to her lecture script, she is constantly carried away by her own thoughts. As the book goes on, her mind wanders unproductively from the history of rhetoric to Thomas More's original conception of utopia to the inexorable threat of climate change. One particularly acute eruption of anxiety takes her away from her house altogether into a Lewis Carroll-inspired courtroom scene where she is berated by a jury of her academic peers. It eventually emerges that Abby has just been denied tenure. A personal essay she wrote about her interest in Keynes became a surprise hit, and she spent years expanding it into a book for a general audience rather than developing her academic research and publishing in peer-reviewed journals. A colleague's accusation that even this work is derivative of another scholar's seals her fate. Jobless, wounded, and at risk of financial ruin, she is now on the brink of spiraling entirely out of control. The novel itself is governed by a finely orchestrated sense of instability. Riker punctuates the chatty narration with abrupt bursts of self-castigation as Abby struggles to seize the reins of her runaway mind. "Stop! You have to stop! What an awful thought! Don't think about this! Oh, God, don't remember that!" Early on, she begins to give a sketch of Keynes' biography and quickly finds herself careening elsewhere. Abby says to herself, "You need to know something about his life, the Victorian and Edwardian worlds in which he lived, in which his morals and his desires and his cares and beliefs were formed, though that could easily be a lecture all its own, or a series of lectures, none of which would be the pithy, upbeat presentation I am supposed to be giving you people, a talk about optimism at a time when I am personally feeling anything but. When I have been stripped of my own optimism by recent life events that I am not going to think about now. No, I am not. Except perhaps just to acknowledge the irony that here I am serving myself up as some sort of expert on how to proceed through the world with intention and purpose when in fact I am utterly lost. When everything I have ever worked for is stop. Just stop." As the night wears on, she grows increasingly unable to divert herself from emotionally risky territory. Abby begins leaving her house behind for long stretches, abandoning her lecture to recollect formative encounters from her past. Gradually, a pattern emerges. Each memory begins with a surge of vibrancy, the intoxicating optimism of new intimacy, and ends with a sense of deflation or defeat as misunderstanding intrudes and one person lets the other down. It becomes clear that Abby is haunted not only by the contingencies of the tenure process, but by the inevitable disappointment of human relations. Surveying the ruins of these relationships, she finds that little has turned out the way she hoped. In their final meeting, the professor who mentored her spurned her heartfelt expression of gratitude. The friend who introduced her to avant-garde music died young after they drifted apart. The high school crush who first caught her attention by quoting Marshall McLuhan went on to berate her for being an antisocial snob. Even the girl she bonded with during an ominous environmental emergency later acted as if they'd never met. The larger world is no less disillusioning. The guest lecture is set 2 years into the Trump presidency, and it's clear that the anxiety disturbing Abby's thoughts is purely political. She makes occasional reference to the horror unfolding beyond the confines of her mind. At one point, comparing the promise of tenure to the security blanket of the Obama presidency and the collapse of this dream to Trump's election. These moments are believable but didactic, disrupting the vividly peripatetic flow of thought with the clumsiness of cliché. The guest lecture is far more compelling when it addresses the chaos of the outside world through the more intimate texture of Abby's anxiety, as in the passing revelation that, well, before her tenure rejection accelerated her nervous breakdown, she had to stop driving. "You drive fine for years, for all your adult life," she tells us. "Then one day, in a split second, it's too much. Not just the lights and the sounds and the fast motion. It's also all the bad things that could happen. You see the full picture and it's suffocating or paralyzing. The full picture is always paralyzing." The novel itself is a paradoxically frenetic illustration of this paralysis. Abby's thoughts race but go nowhere, and no one in the outside world moves to address the catastrophe escalating around them. Riker wisely resists easy epiphanies that might give structure to his formless narrative, though Abby's, quote, sleepless vigil feels like a final accounting, a cataloging of all things, as if I've arrived at some profound existential destination, she explains. It's really a night of no consequence. It's just a particularly acute bout of hyperactivity for the busy brain trapped in this stationary body that will instantly be forgotten. "Everything I've thought tonight," she concludes, "every feeling I've felt, all the extensive mental meandering that's occurred here will end up being for nothing." But late in the novel, as Abby struggles to identify acts that might add significance to her own life, she realizes that her silent, solitary struggle does have some meaning. "I'm scouring my brain for instances of heroism, on even a modest scale. And the only truly selfless act I've come up with is that I haven't budged all night. I've lain here restless and frustrated and occasionally freaking out, and I've not moved a muscle so that Ed and Ollie can sleep. The bravest, most heroic, most unselfish act I can think of over my entire lifetime is that I've momentarily managed to spare my family from myself." This discovery offers little solace. Abby promptly dismisses it as the worst moral to the dumbest story ever told, and the novel's most sustained and frenzied unraveling immediately ensues. But her reflexive self-abasement makes her miss the truth of her realization. Her night-long decision to remain locked in her own consciousness, wrestling with her demons alone, is in part an act of love. This sad, breezy insight, not quite punchline or proverb, is a fitting ending for Riker's strange, little novel of cosmopolitan solipsism. The notion that withdrawing from others can still be a way of caring for them. Next, from the Department of SOS, February 27, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, can psychedelics heal Ukrainians' trauma? A military chaplain, a mindset mentor, and a painter were among those brainstorming recently about how psychopharmacology might help bolster spiritual resilience, by Antonia Hitchens. Late last month, the Biden administration announced that the U.S. would send 31 M1 Abrams tanks to Ukraine. Meanwhile, in New York, a Ukrainian delegation, including a representative of the Territorial Defense Forces, had gathered to consider other types of aid. The goal, according to an ad for the event, was to promote the psychological and spiritual resilience of Ukrainian people living in trauma, crisis, and war. One possible avenue for healing? Psychedelics. The delegation met at a studio in Chelsea run by a Polish artist named Agnieszka Pilat. She paints with the aid of mobile robots on loan from Boston Dynamics, a yellow robot that resembled a dog patterned around the space as the audience arrived. One of the panelists, Dr. Laura Vandenberg, a former Peace Corps volunteer in Ukraine, chatted with her friend, Lee Drew, a healer and mindset mentor based in Colorado who specializes in trauma. For Ukraine, it's no longer about body armor, Vandenberg said. It's about thriving. We have this idea that war is super depressing, super ugly, Drew, who wore a bright magenta jumpsuit, said, but it can be empowering. There's positivity in trauma. They're trying to be present. Vandenberg responded, I'm seeing women who've made the development leap from defensive and worried to beautiful and brave. What they need now is to be able to survive with trauma. She gestured to the Reverend Sergei Dmitriev, a chaplain for the Ukrainian Territorial Defense Forces, who had just walked in wearing his uniform. He's bringing his spiritual practices to defenders, she said. He wears an earring to indicate that he's the last living man of his family. Before lining up to go into battle, the men with the earrings are traditionally in the back. The panelists took their seat in a row of office chairs. Dmitriev kicked things off by telling the group, through a translator, that he hopes to train 1,500 military chaplains in a special spiritual resilience program. A man visiting from Ukraine asked the panel, how can I help the guys I know who have lost friends? An audience member named Jonathan Dickinson, a partner at a psychedelic holistic healing company called Ambio, asked, how are people finding resilience and hope right now? He talked about how for the past 2 years his company has been providing U.S. Special Forces with ibogaine, a dissociative psychedelic derived from an African shrub. As a transition to civilian life, it's about being able to feel present, relaxed, not as reactive, he said. Combat experience requires a flow state. The drug takes you into a nourishing, decomposing state, reconnecting with the deep spiritual foundation people are trying to recover. He added that Ambio is running a treatment center in Tijuana, where the drug, which carries cardiac risk, is administered as a medically supported experience to patients who pay $6,500. Groups in Ukraine are pushing for legalization of psychedelics for medical use, Drew said. Pilat, who wore a velvet blazer and yellow pants, powered off the robot dog, which was whirring. She said, growing up behind the Iron Curtain, when I looked at American industry, I thought, the aristocracy there is the machine. They don't have a real aristocracy, just tech moguls. That's where the power is. Her collectors in the Bay Area, she said, are some of the biggest VCs, and they're all putting money behind psychedelics. She talked about the fatigue with the war that had set in around the world. Talk of psychedelic treatments, she hoped, might make it a sexy conversation again. A psychedelic solution has been already under discussion in Ukraine. After the panel convened, Yuriy Blokhin, who moved from Kiev to Canada and who runs the North American branch of the Ukrainian Psychedelic Research Association, was reached by phone. "Ayahuasca saved my life after an episode of depression," he said. "Then I met an Army Ranger, and we started using it to help special ops veterans. We want to make sure that when the war in Ukraine ends, there are world-class options. And it can become an additional stream of revenue for Ukraine." He added that there was a critical mass of open-mindedness in Ukraine and mentioned the government's dynamic startup culture. Blokhin wants to train therapists who will treat Ukrainian refugees in the use of psychedelics. "It's not a good idea to use psychedelics in country during the war," he said. "Setting is really important, and you want a safe place." And now from the Atlanta postcard section of the Talk of the Town, February 6, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Tots versus Cop City. Preschoolers at an anti-racist school in East Atlanta speak out against a police training center to be built in the woods nearby, then play with blocks, by Charles Bethea. A dozen preschoolers arrived at the Highlander School in East Atlanta on a recent morning. Situated near a few gentrifying neighborhoods and a highway, the school offers what it calls anti-bias and anti-racist, nature-centered learning for $1,300 a month. Its four classrooms have a progressive, eclectic aesthetic, squiggly portraits of Martin Luther King Jr., beside displays of alternative currencies and children's books about activism, the art of protest. Also, lots of plants. 7 3-year-olds plopped down in Toddler 2 living room. A teacher led them through some yoga poses and a Spanish nursery rhyme. Then another teacher introduced the topic of the day. "What's going on in Wilani Forest?" she said.
"Trees," someone said. "They're cutting down the trees."
The teacher asked the toddlers why.
"Because they want to make Cop City,"
a girl in a pink dress answered. "And do we want Cop City to go there?"
"No,"
the children called out in unison.
"Why?" "Because they want to cut down the trees,"
a girl with glasses said.
"And what was wrong with that?" "Because we need the trees to give us air," someone else added. "And animals," a boy named Clark said.
The school is a few miles from the South River Forest, which the Muscogee Creek people called the Wilani before their forced removal in the early 1800s. In 2021, the city of Atlanta announced that it would build a public safety training facility in the woods with a firing range and a mock village. Activists took to the trees to protest what they've dubbed Cop City. About 20 have been arrested on charges of domestic terrorism. In mid-January, Manuel Turan, a forest offender who went by Tortuguita, or Little Turtle, was killed by a Georgia state trooper during an encampment eviction. There's no body camera footage of the incident, according to a spokesman for the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, who claims that Turan shot at the trooper first.
"I don't believe it," Rukia Rogers, the founder of the Highlander School, told a visitor while the kids were at recess.
Rogers knew Turan. They gave her a message on her birthday last year.
"I remember Manuel leaning into me in this wellness tent in the woods," she said. "I was in a bad place. They were the most beautiful soul, totally chill. I never knew them to carry a gun," she went on. "We talked a lot about the forest. They were committed to staying."
Rogers has taken her students to anti-Cop City rallies, which they've helped advertise with hand-drawn signs.
"We've gotten trolled online," she said, "people saying we shouldn't be there."
Late last week, Governor Brian Kemp declared a state of emergency, quote, "due to unlawful assemblage, overt threats of violence, disruption of the peace, and danger existing to persons and property," end quote, and activated the National Guard. They've also taken monthly trips to the forest.
We went to a Muskogee stomp, Rogers said. We planted seeds, took tours with tree defenders. They showed how they got into the tree houses. Then we told the students there was a plan to destroy it. At 12 o'clock, they were like, I'm ready to go to sleep. She laughed. They're not necessarily abolitionists yet, but when they saw the bulldozers, they started talking about building a shield. Rogers was still figuring out how to explain Turan's death. Nothing is off limits here, she said. Clark and another toddler named Lassiter went into a smaller room with Rogers, followed by a crew working on a documentary about the forest. Remember the video we shared of the bulldozers, Rogers said, and what happened to the Wilani forest?
They cut down the trees, Lassiter said, fidgeting.
Rogers nodded. How did that make you feel, Clark?
Sad, he said.
And mad, Lassiter added.
It's okay to be mad, Rogers said. She handed them a few small wooden trees and some blocks decorated with pictures of the students. The children arranged them on a table. Rogers asked what they thought about planting a pear tree in the forest.
And strawberries, Lassiter said.
What would we do if the people came to take them down again? Rogers asked.
We could give them power, Clark said. Super trees, Lassiter added.
Pretty soon, they'd built a miniature forest protected by the anthropomorphized wooden blocks. Clark added a giant tower made from wooden spools.
I'm powerful, he said, admiring his work.
And then after a snack, he took a nap. Next, a poem from the February 27th, 2023 issue, Duet, by Daniel Popick. I wanted to write a poem about delay, the white space between word and music. One night in Ohio a decade ago, under a thunderstorm's bad blank verse. As I counted aloud between lightning and clap, a friend tackled me to the ground to shut me up so he could hear it, the faint percussion I could just call thunder. If I wanted to be clear, I've tried to write this poem for years, but can't and won't, as every line falls faster than I can chase it, acid raindrop. Seeping into clover, garbage lyrics, rising through its stem, poetry almost as toxic as the city, spraying my neighborhood down. A pesticide to X the little messengers, so megafauna can continue, planting real estate. Some sad poet named this chemical Duet. A friend who tackled me got sick. I visited as he received a drip of what I called quicksilver in an early draft. But it was just poison, I mean chemo, which saved his life. Duet on the apple blossom, duet in the core. Nights drift by to be surveilled for words as thunder splits the poem again. Half of it standing up and counting, half of it tackled into clover. Pollen painted with our syntax, pulses once then meets a cell. The rain is light years away. And now, another poem from the February 27th, 2023 issue of The New Yorker, Zelda Fitzgerald, by Aria Aber. It's true I hate the stories about the other women, but I love the description of their daily lives, like the scene with 12 raspberry cakes in a French cafe, or the drunkard asking for the way. A bottle of whiskey on a heavy walnut table. My husband's hands on a glass. No one's muses are believable, said the painter, whom I loved for 12 weeks and who would rarely touch me. To him, the female body was a plant. It needed to be tended and spoken to, but too much warmth would spoil the matter. In his paintings that I like best, women wander through cities and notice objects, lanterns, hats they can't afford, little glasses of Pernod. I loved him,
to hurt the other one, whom I loved more. And so, most of my life, it passes like this. Light touching my skin, lying on the floor among my diaries, writing of him. What did Proust say months before he passed away? I have great news. Last night I wrote the end, so now I can die. Oh, had I known the boredom that my talents had in store for me, I would still have asked for them. And finally, a poem from the February 13 and 20, 2023 issue of The New Yorker, The Blessings, by Evie Shockley. I gave mine away, not all, but the greater portion, some would say. I gave away the ready claim to goodness, to purpose. I gave away Mary, Sarai, and Isis. I gave away necessity and invention. I gave away a whole holiday, but I kept Billy. I gave away the chance to try and fail to have it all. I gave away the one thing that makes some men pay. I gave away the pedestal, the bouquet. I gave away Nell Wright, but I kept Sula Peace. I gave away the fine-tooth comb, but kept the oyster knife. I gave away the first word the new mouth forms, the easiest to parlay across so many landscapes, escaping the maw. I gave away the power to hold and be held in sway. But I kept Cho, Parton, Finney, Chapman, and Tomei. I gave away the Eve who left the garden that day, but kept the cool, green, shady, fruitless, fruitful stay, the evening that did not fall away. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.